today, we're going to be talking about the influence of childhood experience. We are reading several sections written by Eric Sherman, PsyD. He is one of Dr. Sarno's most trusted psychoanalysts, from Pathways to Pain Relief. I think the real heart of this book is its case histories, and we'll be talking about the case histories of Antoinette, Nicholas, and Carl. Those case histories may be pseudonyms as well, or maybe their first names. We don't really know. But I thought I would start out just by giving a little bit of background and telling the stories, because I think the stories are something that all of us can relate to. So Antoinette, her story really goes back. I mean, she came in to Dr. Sherman for pain, but her story really goes back to the age of six, when she really felt outshone by her brother, who was better at her than sports and who was better than her at academics and had a nice laid-back personality, whereas hers was very intense, and kind of stole away her mother's love, is how she felt about it, how she experienced it, and made her very angry. It made her feel unlovable. And you know, when you're a kid, it's important to remember that your parents are everything. They're virtually omniscient. They seem to know everything you're feeling. Like, you know, as a parent, you can totally get away with saying things like, "Oh no, I can tell when you're lying," because the kids really believe it, because you really can tell when they're lying. And so, you know, obviously, I think we all get the idea that parents are vitally important. They're a crucial source of emotional reassurance. And Antoinette's life was going okay, and then all of a sudden, at age six, this little boy came along, this little baby, and he was all of a sudden the star of the show. The cute little baby that took all the attention and prevented mom from getting enough sleep, and maybe mom was grouchy. Whatever the deal was, she felt eclipsed by him. And she felt abandoned by her mother. And then you flash forward to much later, when Antoinette has become a mom. Her symptoms start just as she and her partner were conceiving the baby, and she realized she was going to be a mom, and she realized that there was going to be this little boy. And it, the phrase which Eric uses, which I think is wonderful, Eric Sherman uses, is it rips the scars off of old wounds. And that's what happened to her. Once again, she felt like the second love of her life was going to be taken away from her, that she was going to be abandoned in favor of this young male baby. And sure enough, her partner is spending much more time with the baby. She doesn't know how to take this. She's ashamed, and the shame goes back to childhood, where she doesn't feel like she's worthy of being angry at this younger brother of hers. He's the one who's special. He's the one who soothes the mother. What right does she have to be angry? It's not his fault, after all. So she stuffs that emotion, that shame. She can't articulate it. She can't understand it. She can't resolve it, because she's just stuffed it into a dark corner, but it festers there, and it grows larger until her own son comes along. It's supposed to be this wonderful experience, and it it rips her heart open, and it goes into the body. And she's enraged. It hurts her relationship with her partner. It hurts her relationship with her son. So that's just an example of how that can happen. I just want to welcome anyone who's joined us, in particular my co-host, Bruce, has joined us. Thank you, Bruce.
Hi.
Thank you. If you note, if you connect via the computer, and maybe Becca can send that link for how to do that in the chat room, you can see our webcams if you want to follow along.
It's too bad for us that the chat doesn't have a direct link to this this book forum. it seems like the two are cut off from each other. If you get into chat, you don't realize this is going on simultaneously. Or
You mean the teleconference?
Yeah, the teleconference, exactly. The two seem mutually exclusive, to coin a phrase.
That is a good point. One thing I think we can do with that is we can just draw attention to that in the chat room. The link. So we've developed some what I call copy pasta, meaning stuff that you copy and paste, and I'm going to paste it into the chat room, and maybe that'll help. I encourage anyone who's along, if you see a newcomer come into the chat room, let them know that there is this call-in group, and feel free to grab the copy pasta that I just pasted into the chat room and repaste it so that other people can connect. I think that's what we've got right now as our solution. Does that seem workable, Bruce?
Yep, sure. You're the mechanic with all this stuff. I don't envy your posture, your omniscient posture, because it creates all these discontinuities between the mechanics of it and the way you'd like it to be.
I know. But Becca is incredibly helpful also with keeping the chat room going. It's kind of a three-person operation at this point. But along the way, if I can, along the way of telling the story of Antoinette, Dr. Sherman does a sidetrack, and he talks about how one can re-experience childhood experiences or reprocess them. Experiencing the past in a new way, he calls it. And
this is the part that begins about 51% through location 1354, beneath the three asterisks. Childhood experiences shape our personalities, and our subsequent experiences are refracted through this developing character structure. A personality that is organized so that it interprets emotional closeness as vulnerability will be unable to derive any comfort from that closeness. The closer they get, the more they react, in other words. The more they see it back through their original experience, the more freaked out they get.
Absolutely, yeah. So kind of echoes of the past in the present.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine on the telephone from up at Edgewood County Park last night, and he was talking about how you can tell a whole lot about people if you go to dinner with them with their parents and see how they interact, because then later on you'll see their early childhood emotional selves and see how they cope with the world using these different strategies that they've used with their parents. And you see it really clearly around the dinner table, the whining to mom, the raging back at dad, the whole
structure.
Yeah, and you see that all the time in TMS therapy too. I saw that very much in Alan Gordon's first patient. John, yeah, where he started breaking down into this whining to Alan. And Alan just honed in on it. He could see that this was him talking to his indifferent mother. And that was what he was doing all day long. And that was what was leading to the problem, because he was this child who had never been attended to because his mother was too busy with her boyfriends and her drinking and put him into the back seat. And he was always trying to work his way out of that. And it was his whole emotional tenor and tone. And that's why he was always trying to accommodate other people, get a girlfriend who was the correct kind of girlfriend for him, and to meet other people's expectations as a salesman. And he was always falling behind there was no way out of this. And you see this, of course, in the Sherman stories, too. Those early childhood habits that are immature, that don't really work, but have become die-cast in the personality, have become hardened.
And yeah.
Coping so with strategies.
With, if I can tie it together, with Jonathan, it sounds like there was a people-pleasing thing going on, whereas with Antoinette, there's a jealousy thing going on.
Yeah.
In both cases, they aren't getting enough attention from their primary caregiver, from their mother, but they experience it differently, and that's why TMS recovery and recognizing what's going on is such a personal thing, because you know they both didn't get the attention, the connection that they needed, but they experienced it totally differently.
That's why it's so hard to generalize about the personalities of TMS patients, isn't it? Because there are all kinds of different ways that this problem can develop. These inefficient coping styles, these inoperative coping styles can develop all kinds of ways, like Antoinette with the jealousy, or John with the indifferent mother, the rival. Each has the sibling rivalry built into the relationship in Antoinette, but then in John you have his second class citizen status with his mother all the time.
Though it is kind of interesting how there are these common themes of perfectionism and goodism. You know, Antoinette was trying to be a goodist by stuffing her emotions, stuffing her anger towards her son, whereas John was trying to do it by trying to please his mom, trying to please the people around him, and beating himself up.
You're trying to be the goodest tendency. That's Dr. Sarno would just lump it in two categories.
Right.
Goodest, perfectionist. Okay, there you are.
Okay, Bruce, I am dying for a term here. What is the term in psychology? Attachment. That was it. Sorry, I answered my own question.
Yeah, okay, good.
But for both of them, it comes from attachment. It comes from this key thing when your brain is very, very young. You're experiencing the world outside of the womb for the first time, and you're learning, is it safe? And your brain is hardwired to think about other people. We've got these mirror neurons in there. We know that the brain is hardwired to relate to other people. So at that point, you're learning, can you trust it? Can you be in love with these people, or will they desert you? And so in Antoinette's case, she was deserted by her mom in favor of this little boy, this baby. Mm. And then in Jonathan's case, he was neglected and criticized, and kind of other early attachment trauma.
Yeah, that's a good category to lump all of those things under if you want to make sense out of it. How people develop an attachment to their superego figures. I know that since my parents fought all the time, I was angry that they would not pay attention to me. And the way to get attention was by being perfect. By being perfect and achieving. That would distract them from their constant fighting.
Well, and if you look at Monty Heffley's work on TMS, the language that he often uses is striving. It's that same perfectionist thing. Many of us TMSers are highly driven. Starting nonprofits would be my highly driven thing. So Eric Sherman talks a lot about the past and how, when we are so young, we experience things differently. Our parents are omniscient. They're the source of all love. They tell us whether we're worth anything. But then as we get older, we learn to experience the past in a new way. And if we can get in touch with those emotions, then we can reclaim them. We can diffuse them. We can diffuse our jealousy, our fear, whatever else is... torturing us. And that's kind of the heart of insight-based therapy. We get these insights and we can diffuse them. In the case of Antoinette, she was able to resolve her old feelings because she was able to get in touch with them. He summarizes this by saying, during treatment, Antoinette gradually verbalized her fear that as a parent, she was no longer eligible for dependent care. She verbalized that her fear, now that she's the parent and she has to take care of the child, she's no longer eligible for dependent care. Previously, she expressed the same fear through body language, through her pain, her TMS pain. She was so incapacitated, I'm adding commentary here. She was so incapacitated by back pain that she required almost the same level of caretaking as her infant son. As she continued to put her feelings into words, she experienced them as less chaotic and more differentiated. In revisiting her childhood experiences, she was able to view her emotional turbulence through the light of present-day realities. Her mature understanding that dependency, requiring this attention from her partner, was not inherently despicable. It wasn't absolute. She also could balance that with independence, modulated the intensity of the primitive fears which first emerged during her childhood. Similarly, she was able to revise her previously unrecognized fears that independence always and automatically resulted in isolation. That, you know, if she were separate, if she were the older girl, that she would be alone. And she realized that, hey, wait a second, I may be the independent parent, I may not get all of the love that I want, but it doesn't have to be, in Dr. Sherman's words, a permanent and complete loss of dependent care. She also integrated the newly acquired self-knowledge into her sense of self and recognized, and this is something that Dr. Sherman says a lot, I think it's important that her anger was a private internal emotional experience, no longer defined her as a monster. It's okay to have these feelings. That may, in some sense, feel obvious to us, but on the flip side, it's something that our childhood selves may not understand.
Exactly. It's adult.
Yeah.
It's accepting ambiguities, something that these childhood coping styles do not allow. They're still naive in that sense. They're still operative at 5 years old instead of 21. And I think that's where the Mark Twain quote comes in. You talked about it not applying, but it applies at a higher level like this at the conclusion where you're looking at the two modes of knowledge.
So the Mark Twain quote, if I can jump in, he observed, "When I was 19, I thought my father was the dumbest man in the world. Now that I'm 20, I'm amazed at how much he's learned in 1 year."
I remember that because my father used to use it on me.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It stood out on the page.
Keep you humble. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
As I've been reviewing the text, I note that he seems to talk about this a lot, about the child's perspective. Like there was a section that we did a while ago, like on the very first story about perfectionism and goodism, where he goes into the infant's or the toddler's psychology and talks about how differently. These ideas that I've been trying to talk about, how the parents are godlike, how you're so incredibly dependent, and then I realized that there was a connection to the section in the material that we covered for this recording, where he's talking about how you can experience the past in a new way with these adult resources. So I thought it was kind of interesting to see the connection between those two chapters. Did that make sense at all, Bruce?
Yeah, it
okay.
did. It tied it all together, actually, if that's what you were trying to do.
Excellent. That is my goal. That is my goal. Okay,
and,
so...
Yeah, we should have a chapter, though, in Sherman's book on childhood-naive coping styles versus adult unambiguous, ambiguous acceptance of ambiguity, of emotional ambiguity. It seems like you could write a top-level book covering all of these cases. Maybe we're going to get it in the conclusion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like he kind of slips these in. So as I look, there is this section called Personality Development and Cognitive Development. That was that earlier section that I was talking about in the
right.
It's right after Perfectionism and Goodism. And I think that's how he's doing it, is he gives a story and then uses that story to teach an underlying principle. So in the Perfectionism and Goodism chapter, as he's going over Therese and Adrian, he slips in, he explains a little bit about personality development and cognitive development, and then that's only half the story. It isn't until later on when he kind of revisits childhood in this new section on childhood experience that he starts talking about how we can re-experience the past using our more mature personality and cognitive development, and that's how healing happens. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, very much so. I'm glad my dumb question gave you a lead in order to start
lying. I don't think it was dumb at all. I think it was, it's part of the discussion. By the way, so I just unmuted everyone. I had to mute people a little bit earlier. Does anyone else have any thoughts on this? Like, is this resonating with anyone? Can you see anything at all in this?
Yeah, gang. Chime in. Help us.
Hi. My name is Lonnie.
Hey, Lonnie.
I've been listening to what you're saying, and I absolutely relate to it. I'm just a little curious. I've done some work on myself. I've looked at my past and how I've dealt with things, and you know, my feelings on the way I was brought up and my relationships with my parents, and I kind of thought that I had accepted it, and it seems that you know, maybe I haven't, and I don't know necessarily where to go with it now, you know. I related to a lot of the things in the story that you were talking about previously. My parents split up when I was young, and they had a very tumultuous relationship, and I was always being compared to my siblings, and I relate to every bit of it. But, you know, as I had said, I thought that I had done a lot of work on this. Perhaps not enough. I'm not sure what the next step is.
These practical questions. Bruce, do you want to take that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I wonder if you feel that these coping styles that you understand intellectually are still frozen in your behavior, whether you're still acting out this way, whether knowing has somehow led to revising your strategies, whether this knowledge has helped you work on those naive behavior patterns and undo them.
So you're talking to some degree. So this sounds like an Alan Gordon thing about how you have this, you learn these things from the past, and then they're kind of perpetuated through time via these patterns of relating to the world. Am I right there?
Yes, I know that Rick R. complains all the time about psychoarchaeology and the continuous going back and listening and reprocessing his emotions or re-experiencing them, and this ends in nothing, you know, if you keep doing it endlessly. It seems like there has to be a point where you act on this and stop doing that, you know. You know, it's like Michael Brown asked that question, when are you going to really grow up in the presence process? How do you get rid of those naive strategies. Someone else at the dinner table, like going to dinner with you with mom and dad, can see them. They're just like, they're laid out right there, and they'll see them all the time in your actions forevermore. But do you think knowing these things has actually led to you taking the next step to revising them, or it's stayed frozen in that psychoarchaeology palimpsest loop, if you will, the cult of psychoanalysis or whatever? How do you undo those things in practical terms?
I don't think that knowledge necessarily is power. In the sense, I mean, you have to know about these things, but there has to be an action. And so the action is to discuss whatever these events were, and then find acceptance, and then to make a change in the way you handle with situations. But I don't know that just saying that I've accepted it means that you've truly accepted it. You know, it's still there. It still festers. It's still under your skin. And so that's when I said that I'd already, you know, thought that I had done a lot of work on it, but perhaps it's still there. I'm just not as aware of it.
I think that there are, I think of it like layers of an onion. I think that early in your life, you can go and you can start exploring it and you can make some progress. And maybe you're not quite ready to go a little bit deeper. I mean, I think that the unconscious is smart, and it does prevent us from understanding things which we aren't really ready to explore just yet. And that's good. It's there to defend us. It's trying to protect us. A more present-centered approach might be more helpful for you. What are your symptoms right now?
Yeah.
Emotional ones, less physically, but just what's going on, if you don't mind.
When you say less physically, what exactly are you looking for?
Oh, so what makes you feel that there are these things underneath that haven't been explored yet?
Well, you know, I in the first place, I come from a 12-step. Point of view, and as I've had this pain in my back for the past couple of years, and I've gone the whole route with exploring with a million different doctors, and two different doctors actually told me that I should read Dr. Sarno's book, and so I started with that, and as I am looking back at my past, I've had different I'm at a loss for words. I've had different things going on with me, pain in this part, pain in that part, and it wasn't until I started to examine my upbringing and my relationship with my parents and my siblings and work and my behavior, I started making the connection that Dr. Sarno starts making in the book, how, you know, we have these emotional things going on in our life, and they manifest physically. And so, as I had said previously, I thought that I had dealt with a lot of these things in the 12-step work that I've done, but now I question whether I've done enough and because I still have pain, and so I feel like I need to go and re-examine.
Yeah. But it sounds like as you're doing some explorations, you're not coming up dry. It sounds like you have some leads that you can pursue. Am I right on that, or are you just coming up and saying, I don't see anything?
Well, I have plenty of leads, but I think my question is more like this. If I'm looking at these things, and I feel that I'm dealing with them, like, how do I know that I'm done with that issue and I move on to the next? Because I feel like maybe I'm stuck. Because the pain is still here. I can't seem to get
rid
of the pain.
Right, right. How do you feel about it emotionally when you think about that? When you think about these things, does it make you angry? Does it make you scared? Do you have an emotional reaction?
Some of the things I definitely get angry about. For a long time, I felt that I had gotten the short end of the stick growing up. When I was a kid, a teenager, I had an attitude like I hated the world because I felt that the world had done me wrong. So I definitely had a lot of strong, passionate emotions. And now, as an adult, I'm 43 now, and I try to look at things and put them more in perspective. Everybody's got issues that go on in their life, but I don't know how to mark a success in examining these things and how to move on to maybe what the next thing is.
Yeah. Does anyone have any thoughts on that? Anyone want to pipe in and share their thoughts for Lonnie?
Wow, I stunned them.
I don't think so. I think we have a shy group this week. I think it is a process. It's something that you're going to have to keep on exploring. And I don't say necessarily digging. It might be that you've done the digging that you need to do. It might be that more of a present-centered approach will work for you. Bruce was talking about Alan Gordon's approach and saying, "Hey, are you beating yourself up? Are you terrifying yourself? Are you being cruel to yourself?" Alan Gordon, I think, does a great job of showing people how they actually do that, how they still are terrifying themselves. Another thing that some people do that I personally did is I focused on activities. So for me, for my 18 years of pain, a lot of it centered around avoiding certain activities. And so for me, it was about overcoming that fear, kind of renormalizing my life.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of exploring to do.
I think approaching activities with a new attitude results in diminution of the pain symptoms. Because when I used to go and hike and try and beat my brains out every day to get rid of the pain, all it did was intensify it. But when I go and work out now with a more lighthearted attitude, I notice the pain recedes. And so I must be doing something right. I don't notice I suddenly found out about my abusive father and my all-forgiving mom, and then one day a light bulb went off and the pain went away. It's more like a gradual unfolding process over 3 years, but I guess it's different for everybody. Now when I go take a hike over the same course that used to cause a lot of pain, I'll feel a little bit of pain as I get back to the car and then disregard it. And I won't think about it again when I get to the grocery store, whereas before I was obsessed.
Right.
I was focusing everything on it. And it seems like that degree of obsession is a reflection of your own degree of anxiety about whatever it is that's bothering you. As that anxiety goes down and you get more in the present moment and dealing with things the way they really are, then you can let yourself enjoy yourself and not beat yourself up anymore. But I didn't find any instantaneous cure by any means. This helps, the TMS Wiki helps, the journaling helps, all of it helps. But the idea about going back, re-experiencing some trauma, and then one day you just go walking out the door cured. It seems like all kinds of things together. Taking the initiative too. Like I noticed going out and buying this car and fixing it up for myself. That was probably the first doing things for yourself. I think that is the greatest cure.
Right.
The greatest thing contributing to cure, rather than second guessing and always being worried about pleasing someone or having a superego figure looking over your shoulder or an internal bully nagging at you. Just say, hey, I'm just going to do this and not be afraid.
I think what throws me off is pretty much every day I wake up and when I open my eyes, my back hurts. And
it starts, yeah.
Yeah, right. And so it's hard to say, well, where did this come from? You know, you know, I try to have a spiritual life as well, and So, you know, I pray, and that's the first thing I do in the morning, and I ask God to help me with the pain, and I don't know if that works for everybody, but, you know, that's something that's important to me, and once the pain starts, it just kind of starts grinding away at me.
Yeah, it feeds on itself.
Exactly.
I notice it may even be that your petition to the Lord might be functioning as a trigger.
Mm.
I don't want to say that. If your faith is strong, but what bothered me in the morning was when I would get up and put on my pants and I would hear a click in my lower lumbar region, and that would set it off.
Right.
Then I knew it was there and it would build and build. It seems like you need to just break whatever patterns you have going. Maybe even that prayer in the morning sets the stage for what's going on. You have to reverse things.
Right.
Morning is a special time. You wouldn't be the first person to have symptoms in the morning. You know, as we're sleeping, the unconscious really has free rein, and it can bring up all sorts of things. And so we do have a lot going on in the morning. By the way, I want to say that in terms of spirituality, one book you should definitely check out would be Scott Brady's. I think he does a great job of integrating spirituality into a TMS perspective in a way that won't trigger you. He's got a good program, too.
Okay, thank you
Warren,
so much.
Can I say something about the morning? This is Barbara.
Please
when
do.
Hi, Barbara.
When I get up in the morning, I don't know if anybody has this experience, but for like 3 seconds or half a minute, not very long, I don't have anybody going on. You know, there's no pain, there's no shaking. It
mm-hmm.
seems like when I open my eyes that it's quiet. And then all of a sudden it all goes crashing down and starts in, which brings on depression. And then I remember what happened to me. And, you know, it's just like a shock every day. Does anybody experience that, and how could I deal with it?
I always noticed when I woke up in the morning when I was in pain, there would be a moment before I came into consciousness when I was pain-free completely. Then as my brain started to get active, then it would start with the rise of consciousness, with neural activity, which is a dead giveaway that it's really caused by
mm-hmm.
the central nervous system, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When I was in my unconscious dreaming, in bed, asleep, nothing. But mm-hmm. as I came into full consciousness, the pain would arise and then the triggers would start as to get activated, and it would proceed through the day, and then it would decline at night. Suddenly there would be a decline. Suddenly as I relaxed at the end of the day, it obviously followed some kind of pattern of brainwave activity, something neural.
Which really suggests that this word triggers that you're talking about is,
mm-hmm.
is super important, that, you know, they just add up. So it sounds like what you need to do there is work on self-soothing. I think one of my favorite parts in all of Dr. Sarno's work is the rage-soothe ratio. It's in Mind-Body Prescription. And it's exactly, I think it's a lot of what you're describing, Bruce, where I loved when you talked about the car. That's something which soothes you.
When I bought the car and it arrived with the trailer on the internet, I was so glad that I'd gotten a deal on eBay. I couldn't believe it. I get this great racing car for $10,000, and I'd actually done something. You know, it's perfect. And when I first got into it, I remember my therapist telling me, "Oh, those cramped racing seats will cause you pain. It'll hurt," you know. And I remembered that echoing. And I got into the car, and it was hard to get into, and I had to really manipulate my leg. But with each entrance and exit into the car, I noticed I got more and more mobile, because it was the first time since my mother died that I'd actually taken some kind of affirmative action on my own behalf. And so each move in and out did reprogram the neural pathways, because I was doing something different for the first time in years. And it is interesting, that stuff. But it could be anything, you know, standing up for yourself against the internal bully that you've instituted there and saying, "I will not. I am doing this for me." And it seems like if you're a goodist and a perfectionist, it's really hard to do that, because you're always trying to second guess what the bully is telling you about what you should do. And that gets back to the internal dialogue between the id and the superego that Dr. Sarno says in many places is the underlying root of the generation of the TMS symptoms. Some way you have to actively defuse, deconstruct that relationship between the me that wants and then this bully who's nagging you to do things the right way. And it's all nonsense, isn't it? You know, you live day to day in the moment. And that's where all your pain and anxiety is generated, from that conflict.
How does that sound to you, Barbara? Like, can you imagine thinking about that and learning what soothes you? It probably won't be a race car.
not the race car.
But finding your own race car.
You know, I was feeling a little bit better this week, and then I got stressed out, and everything, you know, the inch of benefit I got reverted, and it's very easy to see what it is. It's stress, abandonment, you know, it's all those things that we all talk about. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I definitely think I need to self-soothe, definitely.
Excellent. Cool.
I did notice technique that Alan advocated of self-soothing, putting your hand across your heart and telling yourself that it's okay, almost in a fetal posture. It does work.
Yeah. And, you know, what I liked about that that podcast, that webinar, is he used the metaphor, I think for Mandy, he said, "You already know how to soothe your daughter. So think about..." And that's good, because sometimes I have to teach people how to soothe. But just do to yourself what you would do for your daughter. And I think that's a great tool, because when you think about soothing, think about what you would do for someone else. Sometimes soothing your friend, if your friend is anxious, just means changing the channel. It just means going and doing something that you love. Buy yourself a new car, or, you know, getting out of the house and going fishing. You know, and there's all of these tools available to you.
But don't you think when you're TMSing, when you're in pain, it's so much easier to adopt a defensive mode where you go in, and keep reinforcing those habitual activity patterns, like, well, I hurt, so I'll go inward, because this is a strategy I've always learned is back in my childhood as a way to avoid conflict, and it gets worse that way. Whereas what you should be doing is reaching out, forming social relationships. It's counterproductive. The things you think you're doing to help yourself are really perpetuating the syndrome.
This is kind of like the limits of psychoarchaeology. Like, you can push psychoarchaeology, it's helpful as a tool, but if you go back and re-experience the childhood pain too much, then you could reinforce the childhood pain. So to some degree, you've got to find some different experience.
Yeah, well, I was an Outward Bound instructor, and I would have to drag behind the group when we would be going up to camp. And we'd have a 3,000-foot uphill hike. And there was always someone at the back of the group who would whine and say they could not do it. And you would have to talk them into hiking up there because they weren't going to get fed if they didn't get to camp. Yeah, you know, real practical things. And they'd say they couldn't. And then they would cop to these psychological strategies, arguments. And they'd say, well, I can't do this because my mother did this to me. And they'd have a whole arsenal of excuses based on their childhood experience. And they'd become over-psychologized and very glib with these arguments. But then you just get down to basics. You don't pick up the pack. You don't walk up the hill. You don't eat tonight. And finally, these arguments would fade away. Their hunger would overcome their glib over-psychologizing. But our whole society is like that. People are really quick to say, my mama, I didn't bond with my mama, therefore I can't do anything. So some of that psychoarchaeology can become counterproductive, is what I think I'm trying to say. They become excuses rather than understanding, than providing understanding of your own behavior. They become ways to avoid.
So there can be real virtue in pushing forward and hiking up the mountain.
Yeah, exactly is what I'm saying. Is the activity overcomes all of that over-psychologized inner rationalization. Really doing something, getting in and out of the car, driving it, going fishing.
Don't you find that the pain just wants to make you isolate, though?
Yes, it does. It loves that.
But my wife and I went and took the dog for a long walk yesterday, and my back was just killing me the whole time, and that's almost all I could focus on. I couldn't really focus on the beauty and all that as much as I tried to.
Oh, Sheila, you're quoting me.
Well, I think mindfulness can help. I think some of Howard Schubner's meditation exercises teach you how to focus on the different parts of your body and project your consciousness into different areas. And I think that's a first step to overcoming that problem you're talking about. Because when you're hurting, if you learn those mindfulness techniques, you can project your consciousness into the surrounding, what surrounds you, and the experience you're having, and not focus. The pain will still be there, but you won't be there in it, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
It can be done.
Did you find yourself focusing more on the pain or on the fact that you couldn't help think about the pain? Was it pure pain, or was it kind of a cycle of, I'm distracted, I can't think of anything in the pain, my life is so messed up?
No, it was more about just concentrating on the pain.
The pain itself. I see. Yeah. I think that advice from Bruce is excellent.
I think learning not to pay attention to it, to disregard it. Like, I was hurting when I walked downhill last night, but I didn't pay any attention to it. I guess there just comes a point where you are able to do that. It's like a skill. It's part of a skill set.
And it does not come immediately. Like, it takes a while, and you have to learn to some degree to relax into the pain, but that's a key part for many people in breaking the pain cycle, because the pain is there to distract you. So if you can relax into it, use some mindfulness to focus on other things, as Bruce was suggesting, then you can break that pain cycle, not be distracted by it, and recover.
Thank you.
But the tough thing is going to be the calendar watching. It won't necessarily be fast.
Right.
Yeah. Steve Ozanich, I think, explains that and gives a lot of hope in his book, The Great Pain Deception, about that. You get a chance to suffer with him through a very difficult recovery. I think that can be helpful for people, is seeing how scared he was, but it worked.
Well, I just got this in the mail from Dave Alexander, The Hidden Psychology of Pain, and I haven't really gotten into it, but I see that he has a lot of positive strategies, actually work strategies, like different techniques that have worked for his patients that are part physical and part psychological, like that, what is it, that emotional transfer stuff with the tapping, and mm-hmm. where you link the tapping with different kinds of preoccupations with different areas and then break it up. It's sort of like modern music, like, you know, atonal stuff. Deconstruction, but he's got a bunch of them in the back.
It does sound very interesting. We should talk about that later, but unfortunately, we are at 3 o'clock.
Time.
Thank you so much, Bruce. I thought this was really good. I was going into this, I was thinking, okay, how are we going to run these things? Like, we need to figure out what the structure is, and I felt like we did a good job talking today. So thanks for your
Mutt and Jeff.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Okay. Hi. Yeah. Glad you were here. And we never even got to Nicholas and that eerie business with the starving dog.
Yeah, that was a little scary. There's another great case history in there. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That was an example of Nicholas had some trauma in his past, someone who was emaciated, who he loved two people. And when his dog was sick, he had a disproportionate response to it because it brought all of that back to him. Another scab, which was ripped off an old wound.
Yeah, they repeat that. Dr. Sherman repeats that same theme in Nicholas about ripping scabs off old wounds, creating a continuity in the storyline.
Terrific. Well, thanks everyone for joining us and for sharing. We will do this again next week and continue the discussion. Bruce, do you think we should do, we could do the response to stress. Jelana says thank you in a chat room. We actually have two, but don't remember that. Do you think we should go to the next stories? I mean, we've spent a long time on Eric Sherman, and I kind of wonder if you're raring to get moving, or do you want to, shall we jump forward and do Dr. Anderson's first story, or what do you think we should do, Bruce?
Well, I've gone through Nicholas, and I'm starting into Carl. Is that where it ends? Is that where we're going to...
Let's do that then. Let's finish up the Eric Sherman section next week, and then the following week. So we'll do all of the remaining stories about childhood experience and current stress.
He has a section on, Dr. Sherman has a section on external stressors versus childhood experience, which is what we've been talking about today. So that would kind of summarize the direction of this chat.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that's what we should do. Yeah.
Okay.
Finish it up and tie the threads together.
So next week we'll be finishing it up and tying the threads together, and then we will move on the following week to do Ellen, which is a very in-depth case history. I think it was a very powerful one done by Dr. Anderson. So hope to hear you guys next week. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your stories.